It's Outdoor Explorer. I'm Charles Wolfort. On today's show, I'm excited to have two brand new national champions in cross-country skiing. Caitlin and Scott Patterson also happen to be siblings and totally charming and real. You're going to love them. Caitlin won all four championship races for women at the recent event at Kincaid Park, and Scott won his distance event with a large margin, and they may be going to the Olympics. Certainly, they did everything to prove themselves for that trip to Korea. Also on today's show, we're going to talk about avalanche predictions. After an early winter tragedy at Hatcher Pass, it's a good time to update your knowledge on exactly what the predictions mean. They're not just a red or a green light. You need to use your judgment. And we'll have a couple of other traits for you today on the radio, all on winter, on Outdoor Explorer, Alaska Public Media's audio outdoor magazine. So I'm really excited about my guests I have in the studio right now, because we don't get that many national champions of anything who have just come off of their championship races. And I've got two, and they happen to be brother and sister. I could say I have five, because they won five championships between them. And I guess there were only eight events. So, like, I've got most of the championship winners. You know, of course, I'm talking about Scott and Caitlin Patterson. Scott won the 15K freestyle. Caitlin, the 20K classic, the championship, though she came in second, right? Mm-hmm. Then the 10K skate and both sprint events. And it's really exciting, and I think Anchorage is really proud of you guys to see this happen. So thanks a lot for being here. Caitlin, thanks for being here.
You're welcome.
Scott?
It's a pleasure being here.
Yeah, and we don't know for sure if you guys are on the Olympic team yet, but it looked probable, right, Scott?
Yeah, I'd say it's probable for both of us. We'll hear the official announcement later this month, I think around January 25th, but we'll probably know a little sooner. But for now, it's kind of waiting for the phone call.
Yeah.
Waiting and cautiously optimistic.
Well, I don't think you could have done more to help yourself, right?
No, I don't think so either.
Yeah, you guys must be feeling great. I mean, Caitlin, did you expect to win this many races?
No, certainly not. My focus is always on distance races, and so I set out to have my best possible performances in the 10K and 20K, and then to win the sprints alongside of that was just incredible. I couldn't have imagined that.
Yeah, Scott, you were racing in your best event, and you won it by a lot. So yeah. You must have felt pretty confident on that one.
Yeah, I was quite confident going into that one. It's an event I've won a lot in the past, and I was able to pull it off again. Being in Anchorage only helps. So
yeah, I wanted to ask about that. What's it like? I'm sure you guys grew up skiing at Kincaid.
Yeah, we've won lots of races, skied lots, lost lots of races out at Kincaid too. So you kind of learn how the trails ski over time. It's great for us to be back.
I know. After this amount of time, it must be like you could do it with your eyes closed, right?
Yeah, basically.
Do you think that's an advantage over the other skiers there?
Yes, it definitely is an advantage. Though, of course, every race we've done there are different variations of courses and different variations of weather, which, of course, we saw this week also. But that's part of the advantage, that we've seen the crazy snowstorms at Kincaid before, mm-hmm. like came in on Wednesday, and we've seen the ice fog and clearing and cold and wind. I've seen a little bit of everything.
Yeah.
So being a skier is all about being adaptable, and adapting to Kincaid particularly was handy.
But you guys are young, but you've already skied all over the world, right? I mean, you've skied all over Europe and done all kinds of settings.
Quite a few, yeah. I would say there's still some places each of us haven't been yet, but we'll hopefully broaden the horizons even more.
We're working on it. Hopefully Korea is coming up.
Yeah, well, we have actually been to Korea.
Oh, really?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Both of us were at the Olympic test event for cross-country skiing last year. Uh-huh. They hosted a World Cup in early February.
So what's it like?
It's interesting. It's a golf course, which your first thought is like, oh, it's flat. But then it's quite a mountainous area. I mean, for Anchorage and Alaskans, I'd say it almost kind of seems like Fairbanks. It's got like the big, rolly hills. It's pretty windy. They have a bunch of wind turbines around capping off some of the hills, but... It's definitely got an Asian vibe to it. You look at the trees and you're like, that's not a normal tree. That's something different.
We don't think about Korea being like a cross-country skiing powerhouse.
No, not at all.
So they had to probably create this for the Olympics.
Yeah.
Well, they had a biathlon venue there before, and they actually hosted biathlon world championships, I think, in 2009. So they had never had a cross-country event until last year, but they'd had a few biathlon. So the biathlon area is separate. It's across the road from the cross-country stadium, but they did have a little bit of skiing infrastructure there, and they have a ski jump, and I think the ski jump was old. It wasn't newly built. It's like being renovated, and everything's being touched up and new facilities.
Is it going to be cold enough? I mean, what's the weather like there?
When we were there, it was definitely cold enough. Uh-huh. It didn't seem like they get a lot of natural snow, but they're fully supplied with snowmaking and ready to blow as much as they need.
All right. So, everybody gets nervous about that before
it
starts.
Definitely, right? Yeah, definitely. For good reason with the way these winters have been going. But last year we got there and there was some natural snow on the ground. I think it got a little bit warm midway through and some of it melted off, got a bit dirty, but at least there was natural snow dusting everywhere. So it looked wintry. And yeah, as Scott said, they supplemented with man-made for our courses.
I just want to ask how it feels to be like, have come through this event where you got to ski at home. The snow was great, big crowds, and you had these terrific results. Now you're headed on to this thing that people dream about. Like, every kid wants to be in the Olympics. I mean, how are you feeling right now? Caitlin, you take it first. You got a big smile on your face.
Oh, yeah. I'm not, it's still sort of settling in. And of course, I am waiting for this decision. Like, I don't know that I made it for sure. Just
we're recording like before we're going to find out. The races have just finished, and people don't know we're pre-recording over a week ahead.
So at this point, we're still waiting, but it is pretty incredible. I know for myself, I'm not a person who like woke up some morning when I was 5 years old and said, I want to make the Olympics. That's not the type of person I am. It's more just making progress, little steps along the way. And so skiing in high school and really loving it here around Anchorage. We went to South Anchorage High School and skied for the team there, as well as Alaska Winter Stars, our club program. And then deciding like, oh, this is really fun still and I can go places with it. So it took us both to college and then to continue after college.
The University of Vermont.
Yep. Mm-hmm. Yep. University of Vermont.
And you're still
college.
Back there.
And then, yeah, my team is back in Craftsbury, Vermont, in northern Vermont. It's called the Craftsbury Green Racing Project. But yeah, so it's been a progression, like every step along the way, when I find success and then I like doing this and then I want to do some more and making progress every year. I wouldn't be still doing it if I wasn't having fun and making progress.
Yeah.
So the Olympics is the big reach goal, and to have it feeling like it's coming so close is pretty amazing.
Yeah. What about you, Scott? Is this something you've always wanted to do?
No, I'd have to echo Caitlin that it's kind of just, you finish one event and it's like, okay, where do I go next? Mm-hmm. I want a national title. Like, well, maybe Olympics would be fun. But I think for both of us, probably really making it isn't going to set in until you land in Korea and start getting handed USOC gear and go through all that processing. But for now, it's kind of like, it's still abstract.
Still feeling.
You're still kind of reaching for it.
Like a little bit unreal, maybe?
Yeah, definitely.
Uh-huh. So I want to get into like your development at skiers and how like the Anchorage community and our sort of Anchorage ski community like helped you get to where you were, and also that you still enjoy skiing, which seems like at this point you could very well be sick of it. My guests are Scott and Caitlin Patterson, who won all of these five major races at the national championships, which just took place at Kincaid Park here in Anchorage, and it's Outdoor Explorer. So were you junior Nura kids? I mean, when did you get on skis?
Well, so we actually were born in McCall, Idaho, in the mountains of Idaho. And then we moved up here to Alaska in 2004?
2005.
Okay.
January of 2005.
Mm-hmm. So that was my high school freshman year, and Scott was in seventh grade. So we weren't born in Alaska, but Alaska definitely had a crucial role in our skiing development. And we moved up here for our dad's job, but also it was a place that we were willing to go because we had already been Nordic skiing.
Because you're already into skiing big time, yeah.
Yes.
Yep. Yeah, at least for me, it was kind of missed the junior Nordic step, but that seventh grade transition was kind of where I went from being a kid who just wanted to get on skis and play games to actually thinking about racing more.
Did you guys jump right into Winter Stars then?
I jumped right into Winter Stars. Caitlin was with the high school program, so she transitioned a little differently.
Yeah, a little different.
But, I mean, Jan Buron and Alaska Winter Stars really kick-started, I think, both of our careers in skiing. We wouldn't be here without him.
I don't think Jan gets as much credit as he probably deserves, because everybody talks about APU, which has got this incredible international program. Yeah. But he's like quite the coach, isn't he? I mean, and you hear him out there yelling at Kincaid, you know. I can hear him over the hill.
Yeah, Jan is really great. Yeah, and so many of the Scott's current APU team, because it has such a strong elite program for these post-college athletes, whereas Jan's program, Winter Stars, just hasn't developed the elite program. So quite a few of the APU athletes have developed under Winter Stars.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a citywide effort.
Yeah. Scott, what's it like being on that APU team? Because there's so many amazing skiers there. It seems like you're just like, I think I had Eric Flora on saying, we may have like the most successful club in the world in terms of just like what kind of results we've been getting.
Yeah, it's special to be on that team. I mean, when I graduated from the University of Vermont in 14, I was kind of looking around at programs and saw both an opportunity to return to Alaska and also the group of guys, especially we had. It was six guys at that time, and it was kind of, if I was going to select six guys in the U.S., it would be that six. So it was awesome to come in there. Eric Bjornsson is currently our most successful distance athlete, and he's a good friend of mine and a great person to train with. So it's just kind of that step. I think we do a great job pushing each other. You have everyone from Reese Hanneman, who won two national titles. So that full-on sprinter, to someone like me, who's not much fast twitch in my body. I need that 50K, and it needs to be hard.
Okay.
So, I mean, we've all developed, all pushed each other. I think Eric Flora has a lot to do with that, but also it's just that great group of guys and women that are pushing each other so hard.
So do you guys get much chance to work out together? Because it seems like that's got to be a really competitive workout.
Yeah, we do a lot of workouts, but everyone kind of has their little specialty. You have one person crushing one workout, and the next day they're off the back, and someone else is a minute off the front. So it's this kind of great rotation that you can really develop as a skier.
So your 15K freestyle that you won at Kincaid, it sounds like maybe that's not your best event, right? If you really like distance, because that's sort of like a medium length race.
Well, it is a medium length race, but it was also an interval start. So as people like to say, you're racing the clock instead of your competitors. And that really plays into my advantage, because then I don't have to sprint anyone at the finish. We've joked with each other that if we come into the final 100 meters, I'm not winning.
One of these days, Scott's going to beat a few more people into the finish sprint. Yeah. But now, I'll keep giving him a hard time about it.
Like the 30K that we just raced at Nationals, there were eight guys who came in together into the finish, finished within 3.6 seconds, and I was eighth.
Yeah, because you had a huge pack, so you needed to break away earlier.
Yeah, it was a tough course, it was not a tough course. It was a little too flat for what I needed.
Tough from your perspective, because you're really into that big aerobic climbing stuff,
Big aerobic climbing, really push people to their limit and watch them fade, kind of.
Yeah. So, Caitlin, you won the sprints as well as the distance races. That's really unusual.
Fairly.
I mean, what's your real specialty?
It really is distance. Up until this point, it's certainly been distance specialty. I'm fairly balanced with skate and classic both, but I like anything between 10 and 20K and the 30Ks as well, but I haven't done quite as many of those. But I think last year my favorite races were 15-kilometer races. So anything, skate or classic, 15K, or even better, the skiathlon, which is half classic, half skate.
Oh, yeah, cool. Yeah. So did you find I would have thought you would be too tired by the end of this set of events to be winning events, because if you've already poured it all in to win three events, now you're in the fourth event, like that's pretty exceptional.
Oh, yeah, you start to feel the toll, and I was really feeling it yesterday morning. Woke up, and my entire back is just tight and cramped and sore, because the 20K, we did so much double pulling and striding, running, everything. So woke up and like, oh my, okay, well, just put on the bib and get out there and something will happen. And I wasn't quite sure what it would be, but I found that actually as I raced throughout the day, I started to feel better. And of course, that final involves some adrenaline and wow, across the line first again. But I think I felt better after the final than earlier in the day.
Wow. I mean, that really speaks to your conditioning and the fact that you must be at some kind of peak of conditioning right now.
Probably so. But let's hope it's not the entire peak because I'm going to keep getting stronger.
It's going to be a long peak. So what is your, training schedule like? I think that like mortals love to hear about like what you guys have to do to be at like top world levels of training. Who wants to go on that one first?
I can.
Okay, Scott?
I think it varies a lot for us based, summer is kind of our training season. Everyone likes the cliche of skiers are made in the summer. And so at this point we're into racing season, so it's very different. Typical summer day or week is kind of how we divide things. I mean, I'm training 7 days a week, twice a day, every day, usually 4 hours a day total. And so usually that's a couple intensity sessions a week. I mean, it's hard to say, but it basically is like a full-time job out there.
Because after you've trained, you're exhausted.
Yeah, there's a recovery element too.
If you're doing that intensity, and probably a lot of weightlifting as well, right?
We don't do a ton of weightlifting. A lot of it is such specific strength that you get it out there when you're roller skiing, when you're doing other things. But a couple days a week in the weight room are important too.
Yeah. Kind of same deal for you, Caitlin?
Yeah, similar. I mean, Scott definitely trains more than me. As a guy, he has to keep up. And so I'm a little bit more moderate. But as far as women go, on the upper end of training. So, yeah, we really, I think my team, we vary a little bit more from week to week. So it'll be anywhere from, say, 13 hours of training in a week all the way up to 25 or a little more. So 25 hours a week is like a part-time job. Mm-hmm. And that's just the hours that you're actually moving, not counting transportation and recovery afterwards and all the food you have to eat. So a fair bit, some sessions in the gym and some intensity, and we kind of follow periodization, which is a big thing in training these days, of big weeks, then you have rest weeks
and recover, let those muscles build in the recovery period.
Yep.
So I mean, you guys both are super thin, but you must eat a tremendous amount of food for the amount of exercise and calories you're burning.
Yeah, people love asking about how much food
absolutely.
You eat. Yeah, I mean, I think a lot of people have read Michael Phelps, 12,000 calories a day.
That is not
absurd.
Real.
Yeah. Like, I'd say 5,000 a day is reasonable.
That's still quite a bit.
Yeah.
So do you have to do any special kind of diet to bring in that many calories?
Or you just, not really. You just eat a lot.
Meals, yeah.
It's less about big meals and more just lots of meals. You can't get by on 3 meals a day. You need 4, 5, 6.
Particular kinds of foods that you focus on? Or
Definitely try to get plenty of protein, wherever that is from, meats or beans or whatever. And I think both of us, just by the way we were brought up, naturally gravitate towards healthy foods and plenty of vegetables and fruits and things, which of course are not as calorie dense, so you need lots of meats and starches too.
Yeah.
But a pretty big variety. And anyone who thinks that an athlete like us can eat anything we want and everything we want, absolutely not true at all. Certainly, you follow your appetite, but I don't feel like I eat everything I want or
can't
definitely
eat garbage,
not,
yeah.
not gorging, not crazy, but just eating frequently.
Yeah, especially when you do these big distance events, like a 50K. I mean, I feel like after like the tour of Anchorage, I'm crushed for quite a while, and it takes a while even to get sort of the calories back on board so you feel normal. When you get up to your level of fitness, is that still true?
Yeah. I mean, especially one of those longer races, a 50K for me, a 30K for Caitlin, that event really takes it out of you. You're wasted after the finish, especially if it's tough conditions.
You have to force yourself, like in those situations, like I don't know, try to find some recovery shake or find something appetizing, force yourself to eat afterwards, because also it can suppress your appetite badly afterwards, or you just really have to rehydrate and refuel.
That'd be interesting. Go ahead.
Oh yeah, of course. Then there's certain kinds of 50Ks, like Scott could tell you about a certain even more depleting 50K running race.
Yeah, there was a running race this fall that I did in Big Sky, Montana. So it was really high altitude, really hot. We were out there for about 5 hours.
Oh, gosh.
And I made it to about 10 feet before the line and then crawled across the finish line when I tripped. And I spent quite a bit of time in a medical tent with an IV. So
we're
fully depleting with an effort like that.
You could kind of ruin your season that way, right?
Yeah. You got to be careful. Like, push really hard, but don't push over.
Yeah, absolutely.
Like, there I pushed over.
The Outdoor Explorer. I'm Charles Woolforth, and my guests are brother and sister Scott and Caitlin Patterson, who have had this amazing showing in the national championships for cross-country skiing here at Kincaid Park. And the last race was yesterday. We're pre-recording, and you're hearing it before the Olympic announcement is made, though both hopeful and have a good shot of being on the Olympic team and going to Korea. So do you guys have other siblings?
No, it's just the two of us.
I want to hear what your life was like as siblings, both being really strong athletes in the same sport. Supportive, competitive. I mean, like, when you came in here, you guys were giggling together. So I could tell you get along.
Definitely competitive, but supportive too. You know, I am really glad we are not the same gender, like the Hanneman brothers who did extremely well at sprinting. I am so glad I don't have to race him exactly head to head.
Like, I mean, again, the Hanneman example, competing for the same Olympic spot, brother v. brother.
That's pretty tough, yeah.
Yeah. I mean, we're super competitive with each other, but we can both win on the same day, which is pretty nice.
Yeah.
So I think it's competitive, but it's more supportive than competitive.
Yeah. Like, so do you guys go skiing together just for fun ever?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yep.
So tell me about a day of what would you do for fun? Like backcountry or alpine or just ski around the Kincaid?
Yeah, I mean, a little bit of anything.
Yeah,
anything,
depending on what kind of day we have. I mean, when training's not so critical, like a recovery day or just after racing, have a little bit of downtime to recharge.
Mm-hmm.
A day in the backcountry would be awesome.
Yeah.
I mean,
And we, of course, I'm not up here in Alaska all that much since I'm based in Vermont, but last spring, the finishing races of the season were up in Fairbanks, and so then after those Fairbanks races, I came down here to hang out with Scott in Anchorage for 2 weeks or so, and we did some good adventures. We went ice climbing, and we went backcountry skiing, and we went Nordic skiing a little bit, too.
We had some good crust skiing last spring.
Yeah. We also put in an attempt to climb Mount Sanford out by Glen Allen.
Oh, nice.
Got weathered out up there, but had a lot of fun.
Yep. So. And luckily I had a very supportive younger brother because it was my first time winter camping and I was in pretty well over my head, but we didn't make it to the top, but we had a good time and I'd do it again.
Yeah, you guys don't have too much fat on your body for that long survival.
Nope.
Yeah.
Nope. Also not much patient for sitting in a tent.
Yeah, really. So that's great to hear that you actually still want to ski when you're not competing, because it seems like it would be really easy to get tired of it. I mean, you're skiing, you're working on skiing year-round almost as a full-time job. Mm-hmm. Do you ever see that with any of your colleagues of like, enough skiing?
I think maybe not so much with cross-country skiers because, well, of course, we don't have snow in the summer, though the APU team goes up to their glacier, and my team, we went to New Zealand and some other places. But you have to do roller skiing, which is similar in imitation, but
not
it's different.
Not nearly as
fun. No, not nearly as fun. Yeah, so between roller skiing, running, the gym time, running with poles, all sorts of other things, a little bit of biking if you throw that in. So there's just so much to do. And then we get to the winter and we're so excited to be on skis, but we still have a little bit of running to do and the strength training.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Scott, do you ever think about, I'd like to do something else for a little while?
I mean, there's times where it's like out there skiing loops on man-made snow where you're like, man, I just wish I could go ski powder right now.
Mm-hmm.
But I mean, sometimes you just have to focus a little bit mentally and know there's other times to do that.
Yeah.
Now's the time to chase a competitive ski career.
Yeah. Well, that's the thing. I mean, so few people get to do what you're doing. And, you must sort of want to pinch yourself now and then thinking like you get to do like the most fun sport there is, which I think we would all agree with, as your job and to be a couple of the best of the world at it in the same family. It's amazing.
Yeah, that's pretty special. Yeah.
So this is a question I wanted to ask. Nature or nurture? You know, here we have two young people from the same family, just a couple of years apart, and they both win national championships on the same day. And only you can tell us. I mean, there's got to be something there about your genes, right? That you've got like this lung capacity and you've got this aerobic ability. But there's also must be something about your rearing, right? That you were into it. So how do you account for the fact that you guys are both such good skiers?
I mean, I'd have to go a lot for kind of leaning towards nurture. Mm-hmm. I mean, our parents got us on skis really young. And I think there is something to talent in skiing, but by the time you're at our level, more of the talent is actually the ability to train than any innate skiing ability. And so I think we both kind of have that right mental perspective. And just how we were raised, skiing was kind of that natural outlet for that, both competitive, both a way to, as well as a way to be outside all the time. And so I think that's been a pretty easy transition for us all the way, just kind of take the next step, pushed by certain people, our parents when we were young, then coaches, all through various levels of skiing.
So. Yeah. Yeah, I think I would agree too that nurture was the start of it. And yeah, maybe we sort of have a predilection to be good at endurance sports, and we're very fortunate in that. But I'm sure there's so many people out there who have the same genetic ability or so, but maybe never saw snow before or didn't have that upbringing with without being pressured, but being always encouraged to ski. And well, certainly I know that for me it's kind of always a cycle. Like I remember in third grade was probably the first time I realized, wow, I have a good inherent sense of pacing and some endurance, because we were running the mile run in physical fitness and PE class, and I could outrun all the boys, and the people who would like sprint off the line and then fade and have to walk, I wasn't one of those.
Which is almost all of them.
Yeah,
right?
Exactly. I just somehow, just as a whatever that was, 10-year-old, I could pace. I had a sense that four laps was going to be a moderate effort. So being brought up on snow and put on skis early, and then having the reinforcement of doing well and making some progress here and there.
Well, as a parent, you know, you want to sort of encourage, not too much. You want the kid to enjoy it and want to keep going. But there's the enjoyment will only take you so far, right? I mean, at some point, you've got to go out. Sort of another skier I was talking to, actually, I guess it was James Southam, who was here almost exactly 4 years ago after he won his national championship, saying, yeah, there's these October days when it's raining when you really don't want to go running. And you still have to do it. So some of that mental toughness, and also in an endurance event, mental toughness is crucial, right?
Yeah.
Where do you think that comes from? Who knows? Stumped him.
Yeah. Good question. It's like just a sense of inner motivation and like competitive fire that I think we're probably on the competitive side of things in academics too, or like intellectual pursuits as well, but maybe not aggressively competitive day-to-day life or personality or anything, but just have that little fire burning and to have a sense that you have to do the hard work if you want to accomplish your goals, and that the hard work will pay off and most likely result in success.
And it is paying off, right?
Yeah.
So goals for the future. I mean, I guess it's kind of you guys are both still really young. I mean, it seems like you can still go a long way in this sport and do it for a long time. But have you thought about what you want to do with it?
I think, at least for me, it's kind of take it one step at a time. Mm-hmm. Like going into the season, the Olympics was kind of the thing on the radar. And next year, I was like, I don't know. Well, we'll see how this season goes. I think there's a lot of skiers kind of in that boat right now that, okay, I'm 25 right now. I work part-time in engineering. Yeah, you can ski for a long time, but also it's like, when do you actually grow up and become an adult? Like, maybe that has to happen sometime.
It's very overrated, believe me.
We're not in there yet. Yeah. We're appreciating it.
Caitlin, you're a couple of years older than Scott, right?
Yes, I am 2 years older. So I also am just take it a step at a time, focus on this year, really big year with this Olympic thing, and then we'll see what comes next. And as long as I'm still having fun and feeling like I'm making progress, potentially keep skiing. But the real life maybe beckons a little, and someday I'll put my engineering degree back to use.
So do you guys both study engineering at University of Vermont?
Yeah.
Well, same kind?
No.
I was mechanical. Caitlin was civil engineering.
Okay.
Well, slightly different.
Yes. There's some difference there.
Yeah.
Very small. Right. Yeah. Right.
Yes. Our parents aren't really sure where the engineering came from or where this amazing endurance talent came from.
You guys like doing things that are hard.
Yes. Apparently.
Yeah. So, Caitlin, I think we're pre-recording, of course. You're about to jump on a plane for where?
Tomorrow morning, I'm flying from here in Anchorage to Dresden, Germany, because this coming weekend, there are World Cups in Dresden. It's a city sprint, skate sprint, and then there also is a team sprint, and I don't know if I'll be doing the team sprint yet, but I'll certainly do the skate sprint.
Cool. How would that compare to Anchorage? I mean, bigger crowds and more excitement, or?
That's a good question. Have they? I don't think they've had a World Cup in Dresden before, so certainly it's a moderately big city, so potentially if the advertising is right and the interest is right among the German crowds, then it could be big. But we'll see what sort of course they set up. It'll be in the city, so ideally should be very accessible. They'll bring in snow from somewhere else and hopefully set up a spectator-friendly course.
So for you as kind of a professional athlete, that's just sort of another event, whereas racing in a national championship in Anchorage, it has to have been something pretty special.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, the World Cups are still pretty
special,
too.
Yeah. But, I mean, it's a lot of races, right? I mean, it's not like one, or how many races for the World Cup?
Well, the World Cup, it moves locations every weekend.
Right.
And there, well, you had 4 weekends already, like
probably
9 or 10 races.
I bet there's around 40 in a season.
Yeah, so that's a lot of ski racing.
Yeah, that's quite a bit.
What about you, Scott? What are you going to be doing between now and...
I leave for Europe in 3 days.
Okay.
So I'm not going to Dresden like Caitlin is, but the weekend after that, there's World Cups in Planica, Slovenia. And so we'll group up and both be racing there.
Wow. So do you guys hang out when you're overseas?
Yeah.
Fun. It sounds like a great thing and a really fun time of life for you guys. And wonderful, you're both having so much success. Mm-hmm. Like if one of you was doing great and the other was struggling, that wouldn't be so fun,
Well, yes,
right?
It is. And there, well, when we were in college, Scott had one really rough year, and it was my senior year, and I was racing extremely well, and Scott was struggling with some health details, and so that was kind of tough. Like, I was happy I was racing well, but come on, Scott, you can do it.
Yeah, it's definitely way better to both be racing well.
Really
like
nice.
Going over to Europe when, I mean, we're so supportive of each other, it probably helps both of us race faster to
I'm
be there,
sure.
to have someone you communicate with better than anyone else in the world.
That's awesome. Well, we're all so proud of you. It's so exciting to have you guys performing and also like an all Alaska sweep of the World Championships in Kincaid. And we had snow and it was cold enough. So it was just a great event. Thanks both of you for being here today.
Thank you.
And good luck.
Thanks for having us.
Scott and Caitlin Patterson are our national champions and have many other credits to their name, of course. Scott won the 15K freestyle at Kincaid Park, and Caitlin won the championship in the 20K Classic, the 10K Skate, and both sprint events. And we will be hearing from a lot more from them. So stick with us. We've got more on Outdoor Explorer.
You're listening to Outdoor Explorer on Alaska Public Media. Find the show anytime as a free podcast in the iTunes store or connect with us online at alaskapublic.org.
I'm Charles Wolforth. The next piece I want to play for you on Outdoor Explorer comes from Minnesota Public Radio, where they deal with cold winters just as we do here in Alaska. Not everyone enjoys it as much as the skiers we heard from, believe it or not, and Suzanne Pico is one of them. So in this piece, she went on a quest to try to find people who could teach her how to not just endure, but to enjoy being active outside in the winter. Here's your chance to learn about non-exercise activity thermogenesis from the Mayo Clinic. Give a listen.
Temperatures around the metro, still a few places that are in the double digits.
It is cold outside here. Make sure you're bundled up.
Up to zero today from the overnight low last night.
Kind of makes you want to hibernate, doesn't it? Me too. Every year about this time, I start to dream about warmer climates. You know, places where wind chill is not in the vocabulary. But I'm here in Minnesota, and I'm determined to find a way to enjoy winter, because it can last a very long time. So I decided to track down some of those chipper folks who actually enjoy being outside on some of the coldest days of the year.
My name is Christopher Wright. I'm from Minneapolis. Right now we're walking around Lake of the Isles.
It's about 8 degrees when I join Chris on his daily walk. And every so often the wind whips around to bring frozen tears that make my cheeks numb. Chris doesn't seem to notice. He's 70 and strong. He's not wearing any high-tech sports gear, but he's dressed warmly in ordinary trousers and several layers of wool. Chris spends a lot of time outdoors, and he has a good reason to.
I started exercising seriously after a cardiac arrest. I collapsed Dr. Zhivago style getting off a bus. And the first thing I remember was waking up with a strange cardiologist.
Chris's doctors told him he had a choice between regular exercise and death. He chose exercise, working out sometimes 7 days a week, whether it's walking or cross-country skiing in the winter or biking around the lakes in the summer. He also practices Tai Chi, but don't try to drag him to a gym.
A treadmill is just devastatingly boring. So outdoors is my choice. I love being outdoors.
Even on days like today, it starts to sleet as we finish our walk. But I'm dressed in so many layers that I decided to take another lap around the lake, running.
Okay, this is awful. I can't feel any of my appendages.
It's not very fun now that I'm by myself. So a couple of nights later, I join up with a group from the Running Room in Uptown Minneapolis. It's even colder tonight, but these folks are smiling as they run.
How cold would you say it is? It's cold enough that the snot is freezing in my nose.
I think it was like 8 or 9 when
we left. Sometimes I say 5, and then like maybe like wind chill like -5.
Are these people serious? -5? They say it so nonchalantly. Talk about runner's high. But I learned it's not limited to runners. The people I met while being active in the cold seem genuinely more cheerful than people who tend to stay inside all winter. Take Cynthia MacArthur from St. Paul. We went out snowshoeing in Crosby Farm Park along the Mississippi River.
It's a beautiful, sunny winter day. A little cold, but not too bad.
Not too bad means 5 degrees with a 4 below wind chill. My feet are aching and my fingers are numb, but I give it a chance.
I feel kind of normal when I can just go out and walk and enjoy the winter. And I mean, really, if you stop and think about it, we're out here right now and it's cold. And yet it isn't that bad, but it is kind of a mindset. It's like winter's here, there's dark days, it's cold, but when you can design something in your life that you can enjoy doing outside in it, it makes it a lot nicer and you even look forward to it.
If someone like Cynthia, who I found out struggles with chronic fatigue syndrome, can be this optimistic on this cold of a day, then perhaps the key to enjoying winter is finding something about it you can enjoy.
The first step has to be made in one's mind.
Dr. James Levine is an endocrinologist I went down to visit at the Mayo Clinic. Levine's in the business of helping people become less sedentary.
We encourage folk not so much to be active in the sort of rather pejorative go-to-the-gym way, but much more in the sense of that if you're up and moving, you're going to be having a good time, you're going to be having fun.
And you're going to be healthier. Levine's research shows that if you're active, you'll be happier, and if you're happier, you'll be more active.
It always starts with an attitude of mind. If you decide for the next hour that you're going to have a really good time, the first step in having a really good time is to decide it.
I guess when it comes down to it, deciding to do stuff outside is the only way to not let winter win. And that means preparing mentally and physically. For me, that means psyching myself up to go outside, bundling up, and knowing that if I can survive the first 10 minutes of a walk in the cold, I'll actually start to enjoy it. And that, I've discovered, is what it's all about. Suzanne Pico, Minnesota Public Radio News.
Welcome back to Outdoor Explorer. I'm Charles Woolforth. We have been dealing in the ski community with a tragedy this year, or late last year, when Randy Burkt, who is very well known in the Anchorage ski community, even has a trail named after him, was killed in an avalanche at Hatcher Pass. And it got me to thinking about avalanche predictions and how we use them. I'm not into blaming anybody who is hurt in any kind of accident. I think we all kind of do our best. But what can we learn about predictions in this sort of moment when you're realizing how important being careful with avalanches is? It sounds like Mr. Burke was super expert and really knew what he was doing out there. But I think a lot of us maybe are not too clear on exactly how to use the predictions or what the different levels of warning mean. So to kind of do a refresher on that, or maybe a first time through, Aleph Johnston Bloom is here. She's an avalanche forecaster with the Chugach National Forest Avalanche Information Center. And we're going to try to cover forecasting for the user. We've talked about avalanches a lot on the show before, and that material is available if you want to check it out on our website at outdoorexplorer.org. But today we're talking sort of about how to use the forecast. Thanks for being here, Aleph.
Thanks for having me.
So in this particular case, the avalanche warning was considerable. And considerable is like, in a way, it's kind of a vague word. I think people, like, when you read about it in the newspaper, you think, what does considerable mean? And so, I mean, could you go through sort of what that phrase means when you're issuing a forecast and sort of what you're trying to tell people with it?
Yeah, I think one of the things is just, it is important for people to, who are using the forecast, to look at, there's actually a little scale on the website that talks about what those five levels are. And I think what happens is that, you know, and there's five levels, low, moderate, considerable, high, and extreme. Because considerable is in the middle, and sometimes even referred to as level three, it doesn't sound quite as scary as it really is. And the big key point in the definition of it is that human-triggered avalanches are likely. And that's really the, like, piece of information. When I have someone see the orange on our screen, you know, the first thing people usually see in an avalanche forecast is a color. Mm-hmm. And that orange goes hand in hand with human-triggered avalanches are likely. Like, that's the biggest take-home point.
Mm-hmm.
And I think sometimes people just think of, like, it's not as bad, or
right,
it's in the middle. And so that's really, I guess, the biggest part of that. And it's easier to say, okay, it's dangerous today, it's high hazard, right? That kind of jumps out at you.
Mm-hmm.
And often, and with that, we always are writing travels not recommended in avalanche terrain. When it bumps down that level to considerable, we're saying human-triggered avalanches are likely, and that you have to be really cautious and deliberate about how you're moving through terrain.
We're not good at that kind of gradation, are
yeah.
we? We're always looking for the binary, yes
yep.
or no. Just tell
yep.
yes, like the movie review. We want thumbs up or thumbs down. But this, that there are very much, there are big areas of gray on something like this, and you can't just tell people don't go, like, because if you tell people don't go, and it's a situation that experts could handle or be safe in, then you're going to lose credibility in your predictions, right?
Yep. And I think one of the parts, I actually brought the danger scale.
Mm-hmm.
And I think for reading through considerable is actually pretty important.
Go ahead, yeah.
So the idea that there's dangerous avalanche conditions. And so just to step back a piece, that there's three parts to the danger scale. There's travel advice, likelihood of avalanches, and avalanche size and distribution. And so where we're putting together our danger rating in the morning, we're really looking at all those things. And the piece that we always kind of sets our bar is what we want the travel advice to be. So how we want people to look at the forecast and then behave.
Mm-hmm.
How do they put themselves onto avalanche terrain or into avalanche terrain? So with considerable, there's dangerous avalanche conditions, careful snowpack evaluation, cautious route finding, and conservative decision making are essential. Then natural avalanches are possible. So there's, you know, if the wind is blowing or it's still snowing or there's a rapid warm up, there actually could be natural avalanches. So that's part of your terrain choice too, that some, you know, if you're traveling under a big avalanche slope, there's could still let go. And then that human triggered avalanches are likely. So again, that's the, like, with considerable, that has to go hand in hand with human triggered avalanches are likely. Small avalanches in many areas, or large avalanches in specific areas, or very large avalanches in isolated areas. And I think what happens is there's a couple things with considerable, and it's the danger level that catches most people. It catches the most experienced people, too,
mm-hmm.
because it's usually right after the storms kind of died down, and oftentimes it's a sunny day after the storm, and the snowpack hasn't adjusted, but we're ready, right?
Yeah,
it's beautiful.
It's gorgeous, right?
It's powder, gorgeous.
Yeah.
There's snow. And so people go.
Mm-hmm.
And they, you know, and I think experienced people do as well. And so a lot of times you can go as long as you're thinking about what the type of avalanche is and where it is in the landscape and then what are your slope angles and How do you manage that?
And it's all about knowing, being able to recognize those hazards in the field. And if you're not really well experienced in knowing what the hazards look like, this is a good time to stay home. Because this is when that knowledge will be most important.
Yep, stay home or really stay on, when it's considerable hazard, we talk about staying on slopes 30 degrees or less. Mm-hmm. So staying out of avalanche terrain, you could still go enjoy powder.
And also away from, as you say, areas that could let go.
Yep.
Then when you get up to high, then you're sort of saying, just don't go.
Yeah, we're saying travel in avalanche terrain is not recommended.
Mm-hmm. And then what's extreme?
So extreme doesn't happen very often, but that's really when avalanches are potentially, you know, it's the time when maybe they're closing the road, potentially closing ski areas, just that there's kind of unprecedented large avalanches affecting kind of travel, everything like that.
Everywhere.
Like there was extreme avalanche hazard in Valdez this year with that big storm that closed Thompson Pass and the Richardson Highway because it was unprecedented amount of snow in a really short time. And just like avalanches were happening, it was affecting kind of daily life.
Hmm. So you put these warnings out like first thing in the morning.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's something to check before you
yep.
go out. What area are you, is your prediction valid for?
So our forecast is valid for Turnagain Pass, Girdwood Valley. When it's open, it also includes Placer Valley and 20 Mile Valley. And that's kind of the core area. And then down just a little south on Turnagain Pass towards Johnson and Lynx.
Mm-hmm.
Then we do a weekend conditions summary for Summit Lake, which is just south of Turnagain Pass.
Mm-hmm.
And that's really the only area that our forecast is good for.
So if someone is looking at that and thinking, well, I'm going to go up behind Anchorage, then it's not valid.
No, that's not. It is a different snow climate, often different conditions.
Then Hatcher Pass is being handled by a different group of people, but also professionals.
Yep. And so they do a once a week product. Their forecast comes out on Saturdays. So that's really important for weekend travel. And they do a really good job of updating on social media when there's added hazard. And then they also, both of our sites have public observations, and that's vital to it. When people are out and about in the backcountry, when they see conditions, they see signs of instability that they write in and tell us. And a lot of times people send pictures of avalanches, or we'll talk about, oh, we felt whomping and collapsing. We saw shooting cracks. We saw rapid wind loading. We saw, heavy precipitation rate. Or on the flip side, it's really important when our people are like, we skied all day today or we snow machined all day today and we did not see any signs of instability.
Mm-hmm.
That's also important because they're larger areas of terrain. I think about it a lot like when my windshield's dirty, if I just scrape off a little corner with my thumb, I get one view. But if I can wipe off a corner and then you wipe off a corner and then someone else calls in and wipes off a corner and then someone else sends some information, mm-hmm. I get a much better picture.
Yeah. So going on the site, obviously, and checking all that out, and we will have it easy to find, but we'll also have it linked at outdoorexplore.org. There's obviously 99.99% of Alaska, which has no predictions.
Yep.
And then there's Chugach State Park, which doesn't have professional predictions, but there are sometimes people making their own predictions.
Mm-hmm.
How do you view that information? Just like it's on the level of what friends have to say, or
yeah, it's information. It's like
all information. Information is better than no information.
It's
I guess.
Good information. Kind of taking it as like I think for the Chugach State Park, it's a really good ski blog, mostly
mm-hmm.
about ski conditions in Chugach State Park.
Yeah.
And that's why, in general, it's great when people put out, send in observations of
just
what they're seeing.
Share what they know.
Sharing what they're seeing.
And that's all part of being sort of a self-reliant Alaskan is being able to evaluate the quality of information, where it's coming from, and how you want to use it.
Yeah, and I think one of the biggest parts of that is if you really are wanting to go adventure in Alaska, in the mountains, it's taking an avalanche class.
Mm-hmm.
'Cause then you need to do things like just recognize, are you in avalanche terrain?
Mm-hmm.
So getting that big picture of, am I in avalanche terrain? Then understanding those signs that the snowpack is unstable, having rescue equipment, being able to practice with it, and having really good travel techniques. And all those things help when you go anywhere. If you go on an expedition to the Alaska Range, if you go to the Tordrillos,
right.
Any of that stuff.
Right.
Go snowshoeing. If you go snowshoeing in the Front Range.
And the raw beginner who just walks into a ski shop, just buying the equipment is like only the starting point.
Yeah.
And I've talked to guys that works in ski shops who are kind of nervous about that because backcountry skiing is becoming more and more popular and got to make sure you get the training. Great. Well, anything else you want to add about using these predictions or the message you'd like to put out to people?
I think there is this national campaign called the GETS. And there's 5 levels to it. And I can't emphasize the importance of that. So it's get the gear. So really, if you go into avalanche country, you have to have a beacon shovel probe. And then consider having an airbag. You want to get the training. So take an avalanche class. And there's lots of free classes that are a good place to start. And then it's really, if you're wanting to spend time skiing, snow machining, climbing, you want to go take a level 1 avalanche class. That's going to really help in your personal predict or forecasting.
Yeah.
The next part is getting the forecast. So if it's available, there's really no reason to not check before you go. Because we really are trying to help you know what the likelihood of the avalanches are, what size they are, and where they are. So that's taking part of that kind of guesswork out. And then when you're out there, you do have to make your own choices of how you put yourself into the terrain. And so being able to, the next part of that is getting the picture. So understanding those, what we call red flags. Is there whoomphing, collapsing? Is there shooting cracks? Are there avalanches happening? Do you see avalanches? That's like the biggest clue there is that it's dangerous.
Right.
Is there a rapid wind loading? Is there, is the snow falling hard? Is it raining? Or is the temperature shooting up? Those are all things that will make the snowpack unstable. So understanding those things and then getting out of harm's way. So really using good, safe travel protocol, going one at a time on avalanche slopes, whether you're riding up it, skiing down it, thinking about where you park your snow machine, where you regroup on a run, all those things, making sure you're not just hanging out in the avalanche path.
Yeah.
All those things are kind of these layers to help you have a better day. And then also just recognizing that we all do make mistakes. That's why everyone from experts to beginners gets caught. And one of the things we do a lot amongst our staff is just talking in the morning. We have a plan for the day. And then we also talk about things that we think could potentially catch us up. Like, are you really tired? Are you distracted?
Think through those scenarios, yeah.
Yeah, and really, really look at pieces of terrain like their avalanche paths. And like their avalanche paths, try to think about like the maximum avalanche or the biggest avalanche that could happen there. Because sometimes I think we're like, I've seen a little slide there once. But if there's a persistent weak layer or a deep slab problem, sometimes those avalanches can be much larger than you think. And your kind of favorite ski run or your favorite slope to ride up is actually this huge avalanche path.
Right, right. Really good points. And if it's considerable, then the risk is heightened and you need to be especially careful around those risk areas. And if it's low or moderate, then it's not quite at that level. You still need to be aware, but you don't have to be like super cautious.
Yeah, I had someone called me up the other day just to ask some questions, and she put it really well. She said, when it's considerable, it's like there's lots of minefields and you're navigating the minefields. And I was like, yeah, that's true. Moderate's still like that. There's just less minefields. So really understanding what the minefields are. And that's one of the other big parts of looking at a forecast is we always have what our primary concern and our secondary concern are, what the avalanche problem is. And all avalanches aren't created equal. Some avalanche problems are easier to manage, kind of smaller avalanches. So learning about each of those avalanche problems and then thinking about what those are like, again, in the terrain you want to travel.
Okay. Great conversation. It's really interesting. I think probably interesting even for people who aren't going in the backcountry just so they know what all the news is about, what people are talking about. Aleph Johnston-Bloom is an avalanche forecaster with Chugach National Forest Avalanche Information Center. Thanks for being here, Aleph.
Thanks for having me.
All right, stick with us as Outdoor Explorer continues. For our final segment on today's show, we have a short piece from Wrangell, where June Leffler from KSTK spent a minute in the cold, cold water with some other seemingly brave or crazy Wrangell polar plungers who jumped in the ocean on a chilly January morning.
It's New Year's Day in Wrangell, and the temperature is hovering in the 30s. Sleet is coming down, and the roads are a mess. But a group gathers at Shoemaker Bay to dip into the cold water of the Samovia Strait.
Anyway, it's a good time. It's the craziest thing you can do on New Year's Day. I mean, everybody wears themselves out New Year's night, but New Year's Day, I mean, it's usually pretty dead. So, I mean, you might as well go swimming, right?
Oh, exactly. I'm like, how do people rationalize this?
You can't. You just can't. You just have to do it.
That's Clay Hammer. He took his first plunge in 2000 on a whim.
Well, I had a buddy that used to go swimming every day on New Year's, and so I thought, you know, I'm gonna go swimming out in the strait. I got to do something crazy just to make this memorable. Otherwise, it's gonna go down as the most boring New Year's ever. And the big Y2K should not go down that way.
That started a Wrangell tradition. Hammer points out everyone he knows and tells me how long they've been taking part in the plunge. One of the hardcore regulars is Dave Joseph. I ask why he does it.
To forget about 2017. You know, it's like a cleansing. It's just something new.
This is his 12th time. We talk some more.
We're getting ready to jump in the water.
Oh, man.
Are you going to jump in the water?
I don't think I'm.
Come on. Yes. Come
here. After some coaxing.
Yeah, let's do it.
You really?
Yeah.
Are you serious?
Yeah.
At this point, about 24 people are in swim trunks and t-shirts. I strip down to my thermal underwear. Everyone walks from the gravel beach into the ocean.
Here we go!
Once everyone's wet, they dunk their heads in for a second. Then we stick out 60 seconds of the cold water, screaming, laughing, shivering.
Three, two, one!
And then it's over. These are the bravest or perhaps the most foolish people in Wrangell. And I feel even more foolish because it didn't even feel cold.
It felt, to me, it feels almost like it's hot.
Yeah.
Like it's almost like it's more of a burning sensation. Yeah.
Hammer agrees.
I don't know anybody that's ever regretted it. So I'll just throw that out there. It's a little hard getting in, but once you're there, it's all good.
That was June Leffler of KSTK in Wrangell. And that's all for today's show. Earlier, we heard from Caitlin and Scott Patterson, our local champion skiers, from Suzanne Picow of Minnesota Public Radio, and from Aleph Johnson-Bloom of the Chugach National Forest Avalanche Information Center. Our producer for Outdoor Explorer is Eric Bork. Assistant producer is Hannah Duro. My name is Charles Wolforth. I'll see you outside.
Outdoor Explorer is a production of KSKA Public Radio in Anchorage, Alaska. Theme music is by Portugal, The Man. Views expressed are those of the participants and do not reflect the station or its underwriters. You can find Outdoor Explorer on Facebook and on iTunes. To see what's coming up on Outdoor Explorer and add your voice to the conversation, go to our website at alaskapublic.org.
Life Informed. This is Alaska Public Media.